Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Good Wednesday morning, everyone. We've got some great guests and conversations this morning. Up first, New York Magazine's Steve Fishman, who landed a jailhouse interview with Bernard Madoff. We'll play some excerpts and especially see how it might help his victims get more money back in restitution, perhaps. We have Bloomberg biographer and WNYC political analyst Joyce Pernick on how the mayor is trying to distance himself from Scott Walker, but the unions aren't completely buying it. Women from Egypt and Algeria today on whether the new political movements in the region will be good for women or maybe not so much. Now, maybe you've heard the news in recent days about Bernard Madoff giving interviews, and New York Magazine reporter Steve Fishman landed a jailhouse telephone interview, several of them actually, with Bernard Madoff on tape. So to add to the existing Madoff mystique, we now have the Madoff jailhouse tapes and his accusation that the banks and hedge funds must have known he was a fraud. Maybe that'll help his victims reclaim more of their money if they can prove it. But Madoff also claims that his victims may lose profit but not principal. We'll hear that clip. And some of Madoff's apparent need to see himself as a good person. Steve Fishman joins us now with these excerpts and what they might mean for justice in the $65 billion Ponzi scheme. Steve, thank you for coming on to share this with us. Welcome to WNYC.
Glad to be here.
And let's go right to an excerpt and then we'll talk about it. Here's Madoff explaining to you his version of how he got started down the path of a fraudulent investment advisory business in the first place in the early 90s, he claims.
Yes.
If he had such a successful, legitimate business going already.
I didn't need the money from this investment advisory business to live on. I said my business was a successful business for 35 years, you know, plus. I said we made a very nice living. I said from that, I said it was not, I didn't need the IA business. I mean, I took it on, and I got myself involved in it, and we can go into that, in a little bit more detail. I said, but I'm not, I said, you know, if you think that I did this, I woke up one morning and said, well, listen, I want to be able to buy a boat and a plane, and this is what I'm going to do, that's wrong. I said I had more than enough money to support any of my lifestyle and my family's lifestyle. You know, yeah. I didn't need to do this for that. I just, you know, allowed myself to be talked into something, and that's my fault, I said, and I thought I could extricate myself after a period of time. I thought it would be a very short period of time.
I allowed myself to be talked into something, and I thought it would be a very short period of time. So, Steve, is he claiming that other people talked him into starting a Ponzi scheme, or what did he mean by that?
Well, it is an elaborate kind of mental gymnastic. What he means by that in specific is that at the point in about 1992 when he had this investment advisory business going, suddenly on the scene come these large hedge funds and big banks. And they, by his lights, talk him into taking billions of dollars. He gets behind very quickly with that money. He puts it in treasury bonds, yielding 2%, and returns to them 15%, just a flat-out lie. And so he sees that it's his moment of weakness when he let himself get talked into taking that money.
Again, talked into taking that money. Why would big banks and hedge funds who could invest in so many different ways want Bernie Madoff? I realize he was a big fish on Wall Street, but what did they want him to do with their money that they couldn't do themselves?
Well, these banks and hedge funds, as we now know, are not money managers so much as they're feeder funds. They're people who, and sometimes they were upfront about that, but sometimes they weren't. They were looking for other people to actually do the work of investing their money. Madoff, by that time, had some reputation for quite consistent returns, which he claims to me were legitimate in large part. Certainly, he claims that they were legitimate through the 70s and the 80s. So based on that reputation, he gets this influx of new money. It's big institutional money. It's prestigious money. And I think the other thing to understand there is that Madoff's view of himself is as this outsider from Brooklyn. He grew up in Queens, born in Brooklyn, who was suddenly visited by the chairman of big banks and incredibly flattered.
And he let himself fall into the temptation to report bigger profits to these guys than he was actually making, and that was the start of it.
Right. I think he ducks some agency in that. Certainly in that last regard, he certainly didn't have to report 15% profits.
So let's go from there to what I think is one of the most newsworthy clips in terms of what it may mean for victim restitution, not to mention Madoff's level of denial. Here he tells you that most of the clients who invested with him are not net losers, and he begins here with those words.
Most of my clients, the individual clients, all are not net losers.
Yeah.
I made a lot of money for them. I was making 20% return for them doing arbitrage for years. All the A and B clients, all of my friends, everybody else, it was the people that came in very late in the game that got hurt.
Right.
So did I make a lot of money for people? Yeah. I made a lot of money for people. Did people lose profits that they thought they made? Yes. But did they lose capital? I'm confident that when this thing is all finished, very few people, if any, will lose their principal.
Yeah.
Bernard Madoff from his phone interview from prison with Steve Fishman from New York Magazine. So, Steve, is he delusional about people losing profits but not principal? Is there any truth to it? I mean, it's so infuriating to hear him make that claim when we know everyone from, Elie Wiesel to the New York Mets seems so financially damaged.
There are two parts to that claim. One is the kind of psychological or moral aspect to it, which he obviously does try to minimize his blame and his responsibility in that. And so that's an overlay that is infuriating. In terms of the numbers, I suspect he may be right. What the consolation is about that, I'm not sure people are going to be consoled or happy. If you invested $1 million in 1970, then you've been living off of your income for quite a long time. If you've taken any amount out, the trustee for the victims is clawing back, but just going back 6 years. So the math actually suggests that you have gotten out more money than you put in. Now, if you look at the restitution that's been made, the big investor Pitcower has promised $7.2 billion. There really is a chance that the $20 billion, which was the equity invested, may be returned or some portion of that.
The other thing that he told you, which I guess relates to both of the clips, is that, and I guess he said this to the New York Times in an interview, is that banks and hedge funds must have known that he was a fraud. Can you elaborate on that claim?
Sure. That's again, a kind of a bifurcated claim in the sense that, there's an emotional component to that, which is that they should have known. Madoff doesn't actually have specific knowledge. There wasn't a specific conspiracy that he's referring to. What he's saying is that I wouldn't give them any information about volume. I wouldn't give them any information about my strategy. I told them if they didn't like it, take their money elsewhere, and they didn't. He adds to that, look, I got 15-18% returns consistently, and everybody knew I shouldn't have been getting them. His quote to me was, if you don't think they knew, they did.
Can that help with the kind of lawsuits that the victims are filing against the New York Mets owner, Fred Wilpon, who they say should have known? Or if they can prove that banks and hedge funds themselves must have known, they have the kind of deep pockets that could get restitution for more victims.
I'm sure that's true. I don't know the legal arguments there. But one thing that's interesting in this regard is that the trustee for the victims has been very aggressive in trying to recover money. And to some extent, he has been throwing down the gauntlet, saying to Chase Bank most recently and to Wilpon, as an individual recently, you guys owe hundreds of millions, if not billions of dollars to me. clearly there is a settlement talk that follows that. But now he has said, this is what I think your potential liability is. Maybe we should settle this. And so I think that we have to consider that there's a kind of negotiating strategy going on, and that people will want to, institutions in particular with large sums of capital, will want to settle this by giving some money.
Steve Fishman from New York Magazine. And people are interested in hearing your Madoff tapes for different reasons, I think. I'm mostly interested in the victim restitution issue. But I think the most common reason may be to simply eavesdrop on the mind of a moral monster. And yet he seems to have spoken to you precisely to try and convince the world that he's not a moral monster. That's your take, right?
That is. Bernie Madoff feels that he's a good person who made a mistake. That is his working premise.
But we'll hear one more clip along these lines. The destruction of his family and his need for them to see him as a good person is one of the storylines of your article and your interview. His one son committed suicide, as people know. His other one gets angrier and angrier, as you report it. His wife, Ruth, at first stood by him but now refuses to talk to him at all. So in this clip, he talks about the anger of his wife, but the end is the fascinating part for me.
She was just devastated, and she was mad, I'm sure, but I think at that time, all she was just in shock.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
And angry at me, of course. How could she not be angry at me?
Yeah.
You know, she tries not to be, but it's hard not to be. And, you know, I destroyed our family. It was a nightmare for me, yes, of course, only for me. I was able to explain it to Ruth. She's still unhappy about it. She's still embarrassed because nothing was going to change that. But she feels sorry for me to a certain extent, you know, because she realizes, you know, I'm not a horrible person.
She realizes I'm not a horrible person. How much was that a theme of his message to you?
Well, he said it a couple times in a couple different ways. And certainly that kind of underlies the argument he's making to me about what he did, the idea being that, you know, he was not somebody who woke up in the morning deciding to fleece everybody he knew and cared for. And I frankly think that's true. It's true that he made hundreds of millions of dollars legitimately, which makes this whole Ponzi scheme that much more bizarre, because in some ways it's a vanity project. I do credit him with being hurt and registering the misdeeds and the unhappiness he's caused his family. I mean, you know, at the bottom of this is Madoff a guy who can have real emotions? You know, having done what he did to close friends and family, you know, that's something that we probably won't give him the benefit of the doubt.
Right. Although, personally, I don't really care about his emotions.
Right.
I care about the crime. I care about justice. Why do you think people should care about your interview?
Well, I think there's probably a couple things. First of all, we haven't heard, from Bernie Madoff. There are millions of words, broadcast, spoken, written, and all we want to know is, why did you do this? How could you do this? So there is a kind of journalistic intrigue, which and a kind of a public hunger to understand somebody like this who could do this. And I think that in and of itself is useful. I do think that the other thing that is going on here in the kind of the twin drama of this is that there is a very kind of small drama, which I find, you know, compelling and heartbreaking, which is what's happened to his family. And
so last question. Do you think he agreed to talk to you on tape to tell the general public something, or as a way to get his wife, who won't talk to him anymore, to hear his voice?
I think that he had dual motive. Certainly he called me to set the record straight, those are his words. I think that he also is extremely frustrated and unhappy that he can't speak, particularly with his son Andrew, his remaining son Andrew. And though he didn't say this, it was clear to me that he felt that if he could make Andrew understand a pie-in-the-sky project, but nonetheless one he sticks to. If he could speak to Andrew, he might be able to heal this wound. Remember that his son has refused to talk to him for 2 years.
Steve Fishman from New York Magazine, his cover story this week, Madoff on Madoff, the jailhouse tapes. Thank you for sharing them with us.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up next, the protests and all the change in the Arab world. We will speak to women from Egypt and Algeria on whether the new political movements in the region will be good for women, or perhaps, and we see what's going on in Yemen today, perhaps not so much. Stay with us.